Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, a special edition of our program, highlights from an event organized by the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa that I was asked to moderate. The discussion took place at the Englert Theater in Iowa City, and it looked at the state and future of our politics before an audience of about 600 people. On stage with me, two bloggers, one from the left, one from the right, Melissa Ryan of Control-Alt-Right-Delete, and Chris Buskirk of American Greatness. Also on stage, NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith.
Let's have each of you, Chris and Melissa, you first. Chris, I'll turn to you. From your point of view, describe the way you see the current state of the major parties in politics.
Trying to figure out what they should be doing and what they should be. This is, in my view, we're in a period, as I said a minute ago, this is a time where things are not up for grabs just for Republicans or for people on the right of center. I think it's a time of a major political and cultural realignment in this country, and the parties themselves and the people who staff them tend to be looking backwards, trying to figure out, the sort of the old thing, the generals are always fighting the last war, and I think that's definitely true of what's going on with politicians and with the people who run the parties. Is they don't quite know where we're going, because there's obviously unrest in sort of the middle working class, but they're not quite sure why. We see this across the Western world. We've had this long trend of globalization and an accompanying ideology called globalism, and now people are thinking, well, hold on a second, we got some benefits out of that, but there was a price to be paid too, and we want to rethink some of these things.
So are each of the major parties, just so I make sure I understand you, do you think they're both seeking themselves equally, or is one more in search of its identity than the other, trying to find a new identity?
Well, I think so. Republicans started struggling with this maybe a little bit earlier, only because of Donald Trump. So this is somebody who kind of comes out of nowhere. Nobody sees it happening. Most Republicans think when he comes down the escalator in 2015 that it's a publicity stunt. But it forced Republicans to focus on this issue faster. This year, I think Democrats may find out that they struggle with some of the same issues. There's a lot of different candidates. There's a new crop of newly elected representatives in Congress, and so now it's probably time for Democrats to start thinking about, okay, what are we now? How do we change and keep up with what the concerns of 2020 are, as opposed to the concerns of, say, 2008 when Barack Obama was elected?
Melissa Ryan, do you differ in the way you would describe the state of the parties at current?
Well, I think we're in a moment globally where institutions, faith in institutions, is at an all-time low. And what are political parties? They are institutions. So I don't think that the Democratic brand or the Republican brand on their own are doing very well right now with American voters. And you've really seen an increased focus on personalities. With the Republican Party, you obviously have the emergence of Trump. With the Democratic Party, we certainly have some new stars that have emerged post-Clinton, and I think have gotten amplified attention that they might not have got otherwise. When we look at the parties individually, what I see is the Democratic Party is now responding and not just paying lip service, but actually paying attention to the constituencies that bring them into office. So they're not just focusing on swing voters in anymore. And African American voters and Hispanic voters have said, we will not be taken to granted. You see the party responding to that. Republicans demographically are in a different position. They are holding on to the base that they have left with everything they've got. I think that explains a lot about Trump. I think about the Republican autopsy after the 2012 election and how the party has managed to do the opposite of that. So I think that explains
in terms of immigration, for instance.
Immigration, racial politics, women. So it's gonna be interesting, because it's a strategy, given where America is going demographically, that they can't continue to employ if they want to win in a fair fight.
Tamara Keith, how would you describe our parties today, our major parties?
Well, so I don't necessarily disagree with either of you, but I do think that for all of the soul searching that's going on, there's also been a lot of falling in line. On the Republican side, it is the party of Trump. There is no question. You go to members of Congress and you ask them about an issue, let's take trade and NAFTA, and Republicans have been totally on board with free trade. And then President Trump was like, we need to tear up NAFTA, TPP is terrible, and they're like, okay, sure. There's been a lot of falling in line. What's fascinating with trade, in fact, is that now there is a new NAFTA, the USMCA, and the expectation is that Republican members of Congress will support it. They will vote to ratify it. If the president wants it, they're going to go for it. For all of the noise that is made by the Never Trumpers, there aren't a lot of them. And members of Congress who I think are sort of representative more broadly of, where parties are, have moved to line themselves up with the president. What happened in 2018 in those midterms was candidates who tried to win by separating themselves from the president did not win if they were a Republican. They're gone. Largely. And so the sort of elected Republicans have consolidated behind the president, which makes sense. When there is a president from a party, they are the leader of that party, and that's just the way it works. On the Democratic side, in 2016, $15 minimum wage, Bernie Sanders was talking about it, and people were like, that's crazy, that's not practical. Hillary Clinton was saying, how about we do 12 and then think about ratcheting it up slowly? And now $12 or $15 minimum wage is just sort of a given among the Democratic contenders.
Chris Buskirk, talk a little bit about your views on the Republican Party. Is it completely the party of Trump, especially with the... Let's throw in the finishing of the Mueller investigation there. Does that have a bearing? Does that shore up some loose ends? Does that solidify his power in the party, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, his power in the party, I think, was pretty close to all-encompassing to begin with. But, I mean, the party, it is the party of Trump. The criticism that I have heard most frequently of when people make that statement, myself included, the criticism I've always heard is that, well, that means it's a cult of personality. And I don't think that's true. In fact, I can tell you categorically it isn't true, because I know lots of people who very much support Donald Trump, but are, let's say, skeptical about some of his personal peccadilloes, but they support the policies, whether it be trade or immigration or foreign policy, where he's been very skeptical of foreign wars. These are things that have changed within the party, because that is, and it's been a ground up revolution.
Let's talk a little bit about social media and the news media and the role that has in informing what we have right here. How do you see that, Melissa? And Tamara's going to be very valuable here in talking about what you have experienced in your career with the change in the news media. What do you think of when you think of how the news media has responded to the digital age and the pressure to roll out new news every minute, every hour, every day?
So I think one of the biggest downsides of social media is that there is a tendency for media organizations to use it as a segment producer. sorry. as a political strategist, this is great, by the way, because if you're really good at sort of organizing online, you can sort of direct the press into talking about what you want them to talk about or sort of buying into your narrative. Trump does this better than any politician I've ever seen. The thing that concerns me about it is most folks, my mom, when she goes on Facebook and she sees what's trending and people are talking about, she has no sense of it. Most people, when they go on Facebook and Twitter, they have no sense sense that what they're seeing is not organic, that what they're seeing has been chosen for them by algorithms, by consultants who push, by PR folks. And then in the same vein, that same happens with a lot of media coverage, particularly in politics, that it's not necessarily an organic story, that even the best laid plans, well, it's trending on social media, so it must be important, we have to talk about it. And that's not even getting into, you know, what I spend most of my time on these days, which is misinformation, disinformation, extremism.
Mm-hmm. Well, and people, like all of us, think that we understand the internet and that we're savvy, but it is really, really easy for misinformation to come into your feed from somebody that you trust and for it to influence you, and it's not accurate.
Another question from our audience. What is the best thing Trump has done as president? Chris?
Well, it's a long list. You want to know what the single best thing I think he's done, and it's not, I don't think it's a policy item. There are policy things he's done that I agree with and that I think are very good. But the thing that I think that he's done that's more powerful than anything else is that he has, he's basically said the emperor has no clothes, and he's talked in a way about American elites in general. Left and right, media, the academy, government, elected, unelected, and said, you know what, hold on a second. These people have been telling us that they're smarter than us for a long time, that if we just give them the power, they have all the answers, they're going to make our lives better. And in fact, maybe that isn't true. And maybe self-government, a more mature deferral to the will of the people through elections is a better way. And he's changed, I think he empowered people to think about that. On the right, it's certainly true. And to be honest with you, the reaction to him on the left has sort of been the same. That's why, you know, you see the Sanders movement, which you know, as somebody who disagrees with Bernie Sanders on policy, I like the movement a lot because it's very grassroots, it's very, it is very organic, and it says a lot about what is best about the political process in this country. And so getting that sort of thing engaged and getting more people engaged and saying, well, hold on a second, we can govern ourselves, we actually know things, that I think has been his best moment.
Melissa Ryan, something tells me you won't agree with Chris on this point. The best thing that Trump has done?
So I actually think the best thing that Trump has done is he has changed the standard of what is and isn't acceptable to do on social media. I would not recommend doing a lot of what Trump does or what he says or the personal attacks, but I think for candidates moving forward or people thinking about running for office, one, the barrier to entry is so much lower than you thought it was in terms of qualifications. But also, you don't have to be a robot, and you don't have to just repeat talking points. And I think if Trump has given a gift to the political discourse, and I use that word very liberally, I think it's that. I hope that people who run for office in the future are more free to be themselves and feel less inclined to be a prepackaged version of what they think voters want.
I'm not going to weigh in on what is the best thing that he has done, but I will say that one thing that I think doesn't get a lot of attention that he, I think, has taken a keen interest in and is very proud of as president is the efforts that his government and his administration have undertaken to free Americans who are held captive overseas, who are political prisoners or otherwise held captive, and he has had a pretty good record of getting people released and back out again, and that is something that I think he's really quite proud of.
And we hear this word again in coverage, Tamara, maybe you can comment on authenticity, that is just, it is something like liquid mercury. You can't sort of grasp it and define it. People have it or don't have it. I imagine reporters covering candidates may recognize it better than others or worse than others. You know, with Hillary Clinton, you covered her.
Right. So today I talked to a group of students here, and one of the things that came up very early on in the discussion about what they're looking for in a candidate was authenticity. Now, what is authenticity? In a lot of ways, it's being really good at seeming authentic. it's like figuring out how to channel a self that feels good to everyone around you in every setting. And President Trump, as a candidate and as president, is someone who is, that people can have a lot of objections to everything about him, but he is who he is. And for people who love that, he is giving them what they want. And I think that, you know, some of the times when he has struggled as a president to say the right words at the right time, in part, it seems to stem, and maybe I'm reading too much into him, but in part, it seems to stem from his need to continue to be authentic, to continue to be that guy who ran for president, who everyone knows, who now is president. He doesn't want to change. He wants to be authentically him. Now, Hillary Clinton, probably because she went through the cauldron of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and, you know, like being criticized for changing her name and having the Rodham and then getting rid of the Rodham and then getting the Rodham back, making some comment about baking cookies. And she became so gun shy that she never, ever in public let her guard down, and you would talk to, and it's not unlike Romney, actually. Yeah. Like, you talk to people who know her, who grew up with her, and they would say, gosh, I just wish you could see the Hillary that I know. And the same thing with Romney, where it was sort of painful to watch him campaign. But then this documentary came out of all this behind-the-scenes stuff from his campaign, and you were like, wait, where was that guy? Why didn't he run for president? So, among the candidates that are out there now, there's a real mix of comfort level, and there's sort of a mix of people who are seemingly truly themselves out there, and some of them who seem like they're trying really hard to put a self out there.
Mm-hmm. We're early on in the caucus season, but Chris Buskirk, as a conservative commentator, a blogger, when you look at the Democratic array of candidates right now, what are some names that rank high in authenticity? Let's just set politics.
Tulsi Gabbard.
Tulsi sure. Gabbard.
Yeah, I mean, she's probably for me. She probably for me would be the number one sort of, or number one or number two. I mean, Bernie is Bernie, right? He's sort of in a way he's the left wing analog of Donald Trump. Donald Trump. Right, Donald Trump. It doesn't matter where he is. He probably goes to the beach in a blue suit with a white shirt and a red tie that like ends at his knees, right? That's just who he is. And he's got sort of that Queens accent, and he talks the way he talks, and he's always got a tan, and that's Donald Trump. Take it, leave it, whatever. And then everybody else, not everybody, but the majority of candidates, it's sort of like, well, if I'm talking to this audience, then I'm going to start dropping my G's. Hey, I like talking to you good folks. And if I'm in the South, then it's y'all. And it's, they try and calibrate whatever they do. Or you come to Iowa and, oh, hold on, the blazer's gone. Now I'm wearing a plaid button-down shirt. And people are like, at a certain point, we got it, right? You have people who do this for you and told you what to address this way and to talk that way. Meanwhile, you've got Bernie. He's got, like, his hair's always messed up, and he kind of looks cranky, like he had something really bad for breakfast. And Trump, on the other hand, is, he's like the alpha construction site in Queens. And people say, well, okay, now I get it. That's just you. I can make a decision whether I like you or I don't.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, do you have a word about authenticity, your view of it?
So I don't have a preference in the Democratic Party. Other than to say I'm excited to see the open call. I'm excited to see the talent up and coming in my party, and the presidential primary is a great way to do that. Here's what I will say about authenticity. Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, et cetera, could never show up to a rally with their hair like Bernie's. It would be a story for 3 weeks. White men get the assumption of authenticity in a way that candidates of color and female candidates don't. Thank you. And we can't talk about authenticity without acknowledging that.
What about Tulsi, though? Like, I don't know if you know this. You may not know this, but Tulsi Gabbard has a big sort of cult following on the right. People sort of like her. They think, you know, this is somebody who I don't agree with, but she seems like she gets it. Like, she seems like she's...
I am not surprised that the right likes Tulsi Gabbard, a candidate who is next to no shot on the Democratic side.
No, but that doesn't speak to the authenticity thing.
I would say that right wingers like Tulsi in the same way that I think a lot of people on the left feigned liking John McCain. It's a similar thing.
Do you think she's not authentic?
So I actually don't have anything necessarily against Tulsi, but I think if she were a serious contender for the Republic nomination, you wouldn't feel the same way about her.
A little bit about issues and the issues that you think will dominate this caucus season. I'll save this question for right now. Let me just throw that out. What are the issues that candidates will be keying on that they think have some traction here with the voters of Iowa, New Hampshire, now Texas, and California? Those are the big states. February of 2020, we'll be looking at those four states. Melissa.
Well, I mean, you made the point earlier about healthcare. I think that is going to be such a big issue for the left. What's interesting is for the right, it's going to be cultural. It's going to be immigration. It's going to be issues around race. It's not going to be incredibly policy focused. It's also really important to realize that what excites the Democratic base and what excites the right base are very different. So it's not just what issues are going to be hot, but it's what issues are going to be hot with whom.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, if you were to ask me what would excite the Democratic base, I'd probably say what Melissa said. I don't know. You know,
okay.
but for Republicans, and obviously there won't be a primary, or there'll be one that's just sort of for show. But what's going to motivate Republicans to get to the polls? It's going to be returning to the 2016 themes, but and I don't think it's immigration this year, by the way, as important of an issue as that is. I think the main theme is going to be rebuilding the middle and the working class. How do we do that? And how do we secure a larger, growing middle class instead of a shrinking middle class in this country?
Which kind of sounds like what Hillary Clinton campaigned on. I mean, when you put it in like those broad terms. Talking about the middle class that has traditionally been a very Democratic talking point.
It's true.
And there is sort of this, I mean, as you sort of like, if you break down the elites and go for the middle, then you start talking about the middle class.
Absolutely.
Today we're listening to highlights from a panel discussion on the future of politics that I moderated last night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. On stage with me, bloggers from the right and left, Chris Buskirk of American Greatness, Melissa Ryan of Control-Alt-Right-Delete, and NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, listening to some highlights from an event last night organized by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center that I was asked to moderate. The panel included Chris Buskirk of American Greatness, Melissa Ryan of Control-Alt-Right-Delete, and NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith. Let's get back to that conversation.
Another question from our audience. Are most electoral votes? Let's talk about the Electoral College. Elizabeth Warren has been talking about it here in Iowa and other places. The questioner asks, are most electoral votes locked in for 2020? So once again, a handful of swing states will decide the presidency, Will the push for popular vote of the presidency succeed in the next 10 years? Anybody on board that besides Elizabeth Warren? I may be missing some here. That the Electoral College, antiquated, doesn't serve our purposes now, especially Democrats are complaining about this, Melissa, right? Because, well, we can go back to 2000. Or we can go back to our most recent election, general election 2016, right? Democrats have a big gripe against the Electoral College.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a national popular vote movement for a while. I think there's several states that have passed legislation. So this was definitely true before Trump. I think you're right that Warren's the only one who has called for it. I expect other candidates will as well. I'm not sure that it will peak this cycle, but I mean, I feel like in the future it's going to be a winning issue for Democratic candidates when they're talking to voters.
Mm-hmm. I think that although there are still a handful of swing states, the hand is getting bigger, or maybe there are two handfuls of swing states, because as demographics change, some states that weren't in play become more in play, and some states that have been, you know, like the key bellwether, Ohio, is decidedly Republican at this point in terms of presidential. So you could end up with candidates already. Kamala Harris has been to Georgia. So you could end up with some candidates, some Democrats trying to expand their map into Georgia, North Carolina, even Texas, although I think that is a little premature. New Mexico, Arizona, I think that, and then of course, the upper Midwest, which was this so-called blue wall, which is clearly not so blue or such a wall. More states are going to see candidates, are going to see President Trump and whoever he's running against in the fall.
Can I just comment
on
that?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
To that point, I mean, the states that matter have changed. I think that was your point.
Yeah, I think you said it better than
I
did.
I think that's right, but there's only probably five, maybe six states that are going to decide the election. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and then take your pick. Arizona, New Mexico is not a serious contender for a Republican to win. Those five states, maybe throw in Iowa, honestly, as a sixth. That's it, because the other states are probably, unless you have something odd politically happens and you have some massive wave election, the other states are basically what they are. They're either red or they're blue.
Do you think Florida is no longer a swing state?
It's not right now. In general, I think it kind of is, but I don't think it will be in the 2020 election.
Address a couple policy questions in our from our audience. Immigration. How do you think the policy related to immigration could be changed by 2020? We listed that as a potential major issue for the 2020, perhaps a general election. Will anything long-awaited happen in terms of an overall comprehensive immigration policy? Will the election in 2020, will we have a discussion about immigration that will be significant in voters' minds? And will something eventually happen to reshape a immigration policy in this country?
So I would say will something happen really depends on the outcome of the election and how much of a majority the various parties have. I think there will absolutely be a discussion around immigration. The question is how much of it will be policy-based and how much of it will be fear-based. And I think that a lot of the discussion around immigration will not be based in policy. It will be based in fear of the other, because we know that the Trump administration has used this as a way to galvanize their base at the expense of immigrants.
Chris, do you see it differently?
Maybe around the margin a little bit. I mean, for sure, this will be an issue that comes up in the election. I still think it won't be as central this time as it was last time, but that could change. But it will definitely be one of, you kind of want to think about the top three or four issues. It'll be, my argument isn't that it won't be in that list. It'll be closer to three or four rather than one or two. Can we get something done between now and then? In other words, that would require congressional approval. I may as well go buy a Powerball ticket. That seems more likely. But I think in terms of how does it get, this goes to my earlier point about how does Trump address the middle and the working class, and I think the argument he's going to make is that the middle class and the working class, their most valuable asset is that they have a monopoly access to the American labor market, and that it's under attack, and that immigration policy affects their wages and their ability to have preferential treatment in this labor market.
The environment is on the minds of a couple of our questioners here. Which environmental issues are likely to affect the 2020 election? More specifically, this other question, how do you see the issue of climate change affecting the outcome of the election in 2020? And furthermore, the policies created post-election.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of remarkable because if you think back to 2008, both the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate wanted to talk about climate change, wanted to talk about cap and trade or other ways of addressing climate change. And now, all of the Democratic candidates are going to talk about climate change. It's a very important issue, particularly to younger voters who are thinking about their futures. And the president is going to campaign against the Green New Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and socialism. And I, like, I know that it's a year and a half away, but I can't really see this going away. It is going to be an issue that the president campaigns on. And in some ways, it's virtue signaling in the same way that saying that he was going to bring back the coal jobs was virtue signaling, that it's a way of him saying, like, I'm for the way it's been, I'm for you, but it's just remarkable because he goes back and forth on whether he thinks climate change exists or is a hoax, and like, you know, 8 years or 10 years ago, you had, you know, Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi doing an ad together about the importance of the issue of climate change.
There's been a lot of political press this week about how Republicans plan to run against the Green New Deal and try to make it sound crazy and outlandish as a way to rally their base. What I think is interesting is how that's going to square with all the weather events and natural disasters that we've been seeing over the past few years.
I'm curious about our audience again on this question here. Okay, audience members, for yourselves, don't say anything. Don't clap yet. Get the top three issues you have, political issues going into 2020 in this caucus season in your head. Very quickly, one, two, three in your head. Okay, you've got those. Clap if the environment and climate change is on that list.
Can we do a couple more? What about healthcare? Is that immigration?
A question from the audience. Will we ever see a strong third party? Are we perhaps even seeing parties within the major parties, within the Democratic Party, that you could, even though they broadly say we're the Democratic Party, actually those identify as two different groups that could just as well be parties? Chris.
So is it possible? Yes, it is possible. And I don't mean the kind of in the Powerball way, like, yeah, of course it's possible, but it will never happen. I think there are scenarios that I think are not crazy in which a third party could emerge. It's happened a few times in our history. It requires a major issue and a major failure. So there's got to be some big issue that galvanizes enough voters to form a party, and there has to be a major failure on the part of one of the existing parties to address that issue. So, I mean, anybody here, I could probably think of an issue and a failure on the part of a party to do that. In the meantime, though, the point you're making, I think, is right, which is that the way we handle that is that there are these, you know, particularly in Congress, you know, there are these caucuses within each of the parties. In the Republican Party, you've got like the Freedom Caucus, and some, there's different ones. The Democrats have their own as well, and they sort of, in a way, almost fill that same function at a lower level with less intensity, but they kind of do that. So you have factions within the parties that kind of work through these issues internally, as opposed to in a more parliamentary system where, you know, Italy's got 12 parties or something.
I would say that third parties, like, political organizing is a lot of work.
Yeah.
A party just doesn't magically appear. It takes a lot to make it happen. There are certainly instances where folks have won municipal office and maybe state office from a third party, and that just, the amount of organizing it takes in such a small geographic area for that to happen, thinking about that happening on a national scale anytime soon, I don't think there's, not like the momentum of it should exist, but the momentum to put in the hours to make it happen.
This is my point, is if there was some big failure, you could see, the only way I see it happening is, I don't know if you agree, maybe, but is if, say, 40 House members in one of the parties said, hold on a second, our party is just, have failed us, and they have to walk out, and they have to be basically the nucleus of the new party. To start it from scratch, as you say, that's a heavy lift.
I wanted to finish up. We've got about 10 minutes or so left of our conversation here. These have been excellent questions from the audience, but we made the point at the beginning of our conversation that we want to encourage sort of not siloing, not being in news bubbles, not only hearing sources that reinforce our views, but that challenge our views, and that's what we're trying to do this evening. I wanted to ask about what I call and what has been called sort of political opposites. These are people you have in your life that are have dramatically different political views than you do. I want to get a poll here, a clapping poll. Clap if you have a friend, I mean a friend, not just an acquaintance, a friend with dramatically different political views. Well, good for you all. Now clap if you have lost a friend over a political feud. Not uncommon. I wonder, Chris and Melissa, to you especially, Melissa, do you make a point of keeping close friendships, keeping in contact with what we'll say is your political opposite?
Well, I'm from Kentucky. So I always find it very funny when folks ask me this question, oh, do you talk to people with opposite political views? Because I've spent my entire life loving and arguing. I also come from a family who loves to argue. So I've spent my entire life talking and debating and arguing with people who have the opposite political viewpoint. And I think that's probably true of many to most of us. I think to some extent, it's this idea that like, oh, the problem is we just don't talk to people with different political viewpoints. And I just don't think that's how most people, even people who live in cities and political bubbles, go about their daily lives. What I think has really changed, and I see this online with a lot of family members, my rule was always, I will never block someone on Facebook or Twitter. That's changed since 2016. And it's not because of any political view or any political content. It is because of the language has become more radicalized. And I've had family members who are sharing extreme far-right stuff that I study in my day job. And that's not a political disagreement. And I worry that so often we conflate political partisan disagreements with larger cultural disagreements. And some things aren't political, they're just not okay. And it is okay if someone is using racially charged language or expressing a misogyny that you disagree with. It is okay to not engage with that person, even if you are related to them and you love them. And I really just want to emphasize that when we talk about engaging with people who have different political viewpoints. Mm-hmm.
Chris, how hard is it for you, or how easy is it for you to keep engaged with your political opposites?
It's easy, actually, and I have quite a few, and I keep up with them regularly. And I enjoy it. And you know, when it comes to those sort of more interpersonal relationships, even if they're in a work context, you know, it tends to be, you know, is there something that clicks between you and that other person, whether and the politics that then the politics become, in a certain way, becomes more interesting to discuss with that person because there's a trust relationship where you think you're both arguing your point in good faith, and you can have an interesting discussion about that. You know, to Melissa's point, this is a place where, with all respect, I disagree. There are things that are just wrong. We agree on that. I want to engage those people that hold those views.
So you would say, don't cut them off.
I don't want to cut them off. No, I mean, because there is. I guess I fundamentally believe in persuasion, and I think that is part of the role that I play. I would hope that other people would take that role seriously and think, I think what that person's doing is wrong. I think what they're saying is wrong. And it could be a small matter policy, but I know that's not what Melissa's thinking. She's thinking really at all, almost on a moral level, I think. I would want to engage that person if I had a relationship with them in a way that I would hope would be constructive.
To that question of engaging with your political opposite is, sure, we can have civil discussions, but what if we don't agree on the same facts? Ask this questioner. How can we bridge our divides? And is this special to this time in our history? When we can't agree on the same facts in so often in the case of the issues that we address, that you're just arguing right past each other.
First world problems.
First
That's what
world
I think
problems.
About it. You know, look, if you look back at early American elections, these are most recent divisive elections are quite tame. By comparison, and somehow we muddled through just fine. Politics is a contact sport. There's stuff that we don't like about it, and there's stuff that I think rightfully kind of makes people a little squeamish about it. But the important thing is that we make sure that we realize that those are things for a season, and after the election, that we come back together and say, okay, that was the election, we fought hard, and now let's get back to the work of being Americans.
Tamara Keith, in your career as a journalist with NPR and otherwise, have you seen facts treated differently? Do we have more of a problem than when you first got into journalism?
I feel like facts have become almost politicized in a way, where, in part, it is the fact checkers have gone to war with the president, and the president has gone to war with the fact checkers. And it has created a dynamic where things that are facts. I mean, when you have CNN running commercials about this is an apple and facts matter, it really does feel like just reporting the things that are out there that are, right. Written down and, in the government statistics or whatever it is, that has become at times politicized. When the President of the United States has sort of at times a loose relationship with, or like when he was campaigning and he kept saying, like, those jobs numbers are a lie, but now he touts the same jobs numbers that are produced by the same organization, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who are just, a bunch of Excel spreadsheet pushers. were those numbers wrong before? Are they right now? Probably really what he was trying to say when he was saying the numbers were wrong is that it doesn't reflect the way people feel. But it does lead you to wonder what is up and what is down and what is real.
I've been told we need to wrap this up, so I want to ask a quick question of Melissa and Chris as sort of our represented political opposites on stage, if you will. I want to see where your visions are for the future. We can look forward to give us in a minute or less, Chris and then Melissa, a lofty vision of where you hope this country will be with our politics in 5 to 10 years, and then I want to have the audience decide for themselves, are your visions really so different? Chris, you're first.
So here's my vision. I'll tell you, I've thought about this a lot over the past few years because one of my critiques of the political class is that they think too small. And so my vision is pretty simple, is that the middle class is 50% bigger than it is now, and that you can stay securely in the middle class on a single income, and that people have the option, therefore, to build families however they like, and that they can feel like they are full participants in this democracy of ours because they have economic security that's brought about by productive work.
I want want to see major changes in our power structure. I want more seats at the table. I want our leadership in all of our institutions, whether we're talking government, corporate America, academia, to better reflect the American population and where we are not just paying lip service to constituencies, but we are adding more seats to the table. I think American democracy will function better if there are more ideas and more inclusion at the table. Okay.
Melissa Ryan, Chris Buskirk, and Tamara Keith, thank you very much. Thanks to our audience at Those were some highlights from a conversation I moderated last night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. The panelists, Tamara Keith of NPR, along with bloggers Melissa Ryan and Chris Buskirk. Today's program was produced and edited by Caitlin Harrop. Jim Davies is our sound engineer, Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. And a big thanks to the University of Iowa Public Policy Center for including IPR in this event. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.